Now, if you're with us on a regular basis right now, you're probably thinking, wait a second, we usually sing a couple more songs. And I know, I put together the worship services last week, but I said, well, let's go ahead and take some more time in singing, actually during communion, to sing some songs about that. So while we're handing out the elements here in just a little bit, we're going to be singing some more. So we wanted to just shift the singing a little bit in the service. Take our time right now to focus upon what God says to us in His Word. So we're turning to Acts chapter 22 as we continue looking at, the life of Paul as he brings the gospel to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Paul has traveled to Jerusalem. He was trying to unite the Gentile and the Jewish sections of the church together with a love offering for the poor saints in Jerusalem. We don't know how that went. Luke doesn't even record for us that he delivered it. We know that he did because his epistles talk about delivering it. But while he was there, in another effort to try to unite the church by taking part in a ritual at temple worship and offering some sacrifices and fulfilling a vow with some Jewish Christian men, he was arrested in the temple by the Jews who were there, the unbelieving Jews, who thought that he had desecrated the temple by bringing a Gentile into the temple precincts. That was an offense punishable by death, and even Roman law allowed the Jewish people to execute summarily people who violated that law. And so they dragged him out of the temple, started beating him, but the leader of the Roman garrison in Jerusalem stepped in to try to figure out what was going on and took Paul into custody. Well, Paul asked if he could address the Jewish people from the steps going up to the Roman fortress, and the Roman commander said, sure, go ahead. So Paul gave us the speech that we looked at last time, and he was giving his testimony of how Christ had transformed his life, how Christ is the fulfillment of all the expectations of the Jewish people, and everybody was listening. There was a great silence, a hush that fell over the crowds, until Paul got to verse 21, where he says that Christ told me, go away, I'll send you to the Gentiles because the Jews won't listen to you. When Paul, right there, declares that the gospel is a gospel of grace, not of works, because God's accepting Gentiles on the same basis that He accepts Jews, meaning that all that Jewish heritage doesn't amount to anything as far as earning favor with God. All of that practicing the Jewish ritual doesn't amount to anything as far as earning favor from God. Now there's value in it. There's blessing in it. Paul talks about that in Romans, that there was great blessing to being raised as a Jewish person because they had access to the Scriptures. It was one of the great things that Paul talked about. And so it's not that there is no value in being raised Jewish. It's just if you come to God with anything that says, well, I'm acceptable because I have fill in the blank. Our kids are doing algebra right now. That's where you plug in the variable X. I am acceptable to God because I have X or Y or Z. Immediately the equation falls apart because there is nothing you can present to God to earn His favor. Nothing. We all stand in debt to God. He never stands in debt to us. He never stands in a position where He owes us His favor. We always come to Him on our knees. Always with our hands out asking for mercy, the Jews and the Gentiles. And both of those people groups can only be accepted before God on the basis of their faith in Messiah Jesus who died for their sins. There is nothing else. And so as Paul is telling them, hey, I was sent to the Gentiles to preach this message, that God accepts Gentiles on the basis of faith, the Jewish people erupted in anger and said, what are you saying? The temple means nothing? Our Jewish customs mean nothing? Our Jewish heritage means nothing? And here's what they cry out up in verse 22. Up to this word, they listen to him. And then they raise their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth. That's an expression, by the way, that means kill him. Away with him. Away with him. You know, we throw things away, right? We have little cans that we keep in our kitchen. They got a plastic bag in them. We throw things away. Well, where is away? You put it in there because you want it to be out of sight, out of mind. You want to get rid of it. And that's kind of the picture here. You know, we know it gets hauled off in the garbage can, taken off to the dump and buried somewhere. They want Paul done away with. Away with him. Throw him away like garbage. Get rid of him. Why? Because he should not be allowed to live. He's not fit to live. Because in their estimation, a guy that thinks Gentiles are just as acceptable to God as Jews is unfit to live. And this is where they've come to. Now, verse 23, as they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust into the air, you can see their reaction to this message is extremely vehement. The tribune ordered him to be brought into the barracks. Now, I need you to put yourself in the place of the tribune here for a moment. Here, this guy has rushed down into the temple to stop a riot that's going on. When he gets down to the temple, he finds this mob of people beating the daylights out of Paul. So he separates them, he pulls Paul and puts him in protective custody with the soldiers, starts trying to figure out what's going on. But there's so many people shouting different accusations at Paul that he can't get an answer, so he starts taking Paul, carrying him by the soldiers, carrying him up to the fortress. The whole time, the Jewish mob is still trying to tear Paul apart. So they're trying to reach in and grab him through the Roman soldiers. Well, they get up onto the steps of the fortress, and Paul says, "Hey, can I say something to you?" And he's speaking very good Greek. The commander is surprised by that because he thinks Paul's a rebel. He thinks he's a Jewish troublemaker. And so when Paul asks him very, very politely if he can address the people, the commander allows it. And so Paul stands there and begins speaking to the people, not in the Greek, but in Hebrew. You're a Greek centurion. Do you probably know Hebrew? Sorry, not centurion. You're commander of 1,000. Do you probably know Hebrew? You might know a few words here and there, but my guess is this commander has no idea what Paul just said to the people. But when Paul stretches out his hands at the beginning of the speech and starts talking, and everybody gets this great calm, and they listen all the way, but then all of a sudden, they jump up, they start throwing dust in the air, ripping off their cloaks, throwing them at Paul, screaming, "Away, away, kill the guy." Now, this poor commander is in such a state of disarray. He has no idea what's going on here, so his only option that he can come up with is, all right, we got to take Paul back into the barracks and we're going to whip him to figure out what's going on. And so he orders him, take him back into the barracks, saying that he should be examined by flogging to find out why they were shouting against him like this. So good chance that this Roman commander has no idea what Paul just said to the people. He doesn't know why those people are so angry at him. And as the one responsible to keep order in Jerusalem, he has to be able to fill out the report. The daily report's got to say, stop the riot in Jerusalem. It was caused by whatever. If he says, stop the riot in Jerusalem and gives no explanation, he's going to be in trouble. So he wants his paperwork to be nice and neat and tidy. And so he says, okay, let's take this guy back into the barracks. We'll whip him a few times. He'll probably tell us what's going on, and then I'll have something to put into my report. Now, one of the tricks is we know from history what Roman flogging looked like. Back in Philippi, Paul was beaten with Silas and put into prison by the Roman magistrates in the city of Philippi. In that instance, the word that's used indicates that they used canes, sort of like a switch. And it was a beating, it was painful, but it wasn't necessarily life-threatening. In this instance, the Roman whips that were used were the same kind that were used on Christ. We know that there was a wooden handle, and they had many long leather straps coming out of it, and the Romans would embed those leather straps with bits of bone and metal. So you can imagine what this might do to the flesh of some poor person receiving these things. This wasn't a whipping just designed to discipline. This was serious. This was life-threatening. Oftentimes, people who endured this kind of whipping died as a result of the whipping or from the infection that would probably follow. So you can understand why Paul's going to make a decision here that he does. So they take him into the barracks, and it says that, verse 25, when they had stretched him out for the whip, so they would tie his hands, pull him up, and keep his body nice and stretched tight so that he would be unable to move out of the way. So that when the Roman soldiers began administering this flogging, there would be little Paul could do about it except endure it. When they had stretched him out for the whips, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, the guy that has been in charge of this so far is called a commander of thousands, the Roman commander. This centurion would be the next level down in the chain of command. So the commander has turned over the interrogations to a centurion, who is now standing here with probably a couple of soldiers guarding Paul and a guy that would have the whip in his hand and actually administer the whipping. So Paul looks to the Roman centurion who's standing by and who is in charge of this interrogation and asks him a very, very simple question. Is it lawful for you to flog a man who is a Roman citizen and uncondemned? Now, this would kind of be akin to us saying here, is it lawful for the police to come into your house without a warrant? We would say, no. No, they're not allowed. Constitutional rights guarantee us that. He's asking a question, but he is more so making a statement, and that statement is, but he's doing it very, very politely, very respectfully. He says, I'm a Roman citizen. I'm uncondemned, meaning I haven't had a trial. I haven't been condemned by a fair trial, but you're about to beat me, and this is in violation of my rights as a Roman citizen. Now, this has got to be a surprise to these Romans standing here, because from all appearances, Paul is just a Jew. He looks like a Jew. He speaks Hebrew like a Jew. He does know some Greek, but that's not unusual for a Jewish person either. Greek was very, very common to know. But while he's stretched out there and he asks this simple question, it would have gotten that Roman centurion thinking on this line of reasoning. If this guy's a Roman and I beat him without him being condemned, I can suffer whatever fate he suffers. If I beat him, I could be beaten. If he dies, I could be executed. Roman citizens were protected under law. Non-citizens, they didn't care about. And that's why they're stringing him up. They think he's a non-citizen, so they don't care about whatever rights he thinks he might have. They're just going to beat him and try to find out what's going on. But now that they find out he is a citizen, or at least claims to be, now we've got a much more important situation going on here. So the Roman centurion, taking the hint of Paul's question, verse 26, when he heard this, he went to the tribune, that's the commander of thousands, and said to him, what are you about to do? This man is a Roman citizen. Now, historically speaking, we're not sure if there was any kind of documentation by which Paul could prove his citizenship. Some have asserted that they would carry some kind of parchment or seal that would show their Roman citizenship, or maybe some kind of a coin. But the fact of the matter that we do know is that claims to Roman citizenship were very, very serious. If you claimed to be a Roman citizen and you were not, and it was found out, you would be executed. They didn't take these things lightly. And so most of the time, someone who claimed to be a citizen, their word was simply taken on the matter. And Paul's going to give a little backing of evidence here in just a moment, but this claim is accepted at face value, so the centurion goes to the commander, the tribune, and simply says, what are you doing? This guy's a Roman citizen. Did you know that? If you didn't know that, why didn't you know that? And if you know that now, what are you going to do? We can't beat him, because if we beat him, we're going to get beaten. The centurion the guy who actually does the beating could be beaten himself, and the tribune, the commander of thousands, could lose whatever rank and title he has earned thus far in his career. This was a very, very serious matter, and Roman citizenship provided this to Paul. So, verse 27, the tribune came and said to Paul, tell me, are you a Roman citizen? And he said, yes. And once again, very simple question. He's not going to demand any proof of it, because you just simply wouldn't dare to claim Roman citizenship if you didn't actually have it. It was too serious of a matter. The tribune responds with a very interesting response. Verse 28, he says, "The tribune answered, 'I bought this citizenship for a large sum.'" Now, historically speaking, we know that most of the time in the Roman Empire, citizenship was not for sale. Because it was such a prized, valuable thing, you couldn't buy it. You were born with it, or it was granted to you as a reward for some favor. Sometimes soldiers would be given citizenship for faithful service. Sometimes entire cities were granted citizenship for some loyalty to the empire. But only in the reign of Emperor Claudius, who reigned from 41 AD to 54 AD, during his reign, citizenship came to be something that could be bribed. You could buy it. At the beginning of his reign, it was kind of expensive. As his reign went on, he and his wife began selling it off at cheaper and cheaper prices. And they used it to gain for themselves a lot of money and a lot of favors that people owed them. And so when this tribune says, "I bought this citizenship for a large sum," that gives us a little bit of a clue that he bought this during the reign of Emperor Claudius. And we'll find out just a little bit later, too. He writes a letter trying to explain what's been going on here. And verse 26 of chapter 23, he uses his name and says, "Claudius Lysias." Probably he took the name Claudius for the emperor who gave him or sold him the citizenship. And so that gives us a hint that it probably was earlier in Claudius's reign, so maybe in the early 40s, mid-40s. But what the man is saying here, and there are some differences when you look at the scholars as to what he's trying to say, but I think the one that makes the most sense is he's being somewhat facetious. You say, well, I bought this for a large sum. How did you get it? Boy, they'll give out citizenship to anybody these days, won't they? I mean, if they're going to give it to you, Paul, how did you acquire it? Because it cost me a lot of money. It was something valuable enough to me that I spent a ton of money on this citizenship. How did you come to have it? Paul's answer probably surprised him. Because Paul says, "I was actually born this way." Now, there was the estimation in people's minds that if you acquired citizenship recently, you were kind of a second-class citizen. If you were born a citizen, that was something different. And so Paul here can actually make this claim to say, I'm a little bit higher status than you are, Commander, because I was born with Roman citizenship. Now, he's already told him back before he spoke to the crowds, he told him that he was born in Tarsus, which is a Roman city. And so it shouldn't surprise him, and that's probably why Lysias doesn't question Paul's claim to Roman citizenship. So, well, you were born in the Roman city, that would make sense. Now, how Paul's family came to be Roman citizens, we don't know. There's no historical evidence anywhere outside in the scripture or outside of it that tells us how this came to be, but it simply is. Paul makes the claim. It's not questioned by the Roman tribune here. Paul is a Roman citizen. He's made the claim before back in Philippi. So, verse 29, those who were about to examine him withdrew from him immediately. They recognized the seriousness of the situation here. You weren't even allowed to strap the guy up, get him ready to be beaten if he's a Roman citizen, because he hasn't gone through a trial yet. And the tribune also was afraid, for he realized that Paul was a Roman citizen and that he had bound him. This puts him in a really kind of a predicament. Now, he's going to be able to say, well, I didn't know he was a Roman citizen, but the fact that he is a Roman citizen makes this commander somewhat culpable for even strapping him up and getting ready to beat him. A part of the question we ask as we come to the end of that section is, back in Philippi, Paul was beaten, thrown in prison, and the next day when they wanted to release him, he said, oh, no, you're not just going to get out of this easy. You beat me and I'm a Roman citizen. You did it without a trial. Why is it that back in Philippi, he endured the beating and then claimed his Roman citizenship, and here he's going to claim it ahead of time? Well, I'm making a little bit of a speculation here. And so understand, the text doesn't tell us why he does it this way. But back in Philippi, there were other people with him. And the fate of the church was kind of hanging in the balance. And so I think that Paul wanted to make a statement that if the church was going to suffer, he was going to suffer with them. He wasn't going to use his Roman citizenship to escape while his fellow Christians were going to be persecuted. And so he didn't pull out his Roman citizenship card until after it was over. And at that point, he's able to pull out his citizenship card as a means to tell the city magistrates, you'd better be careful next time. Don't just pull these Christians into prison and beat them and throw them in prison and mistreat them just because they're Christians, because some of us are Roman citizens. We demand to be protected that way. And so he was able to use his citizenship there to accomplish protection for the church. Here, Paul's not being strung up because he's a Christian. He's being strung up because he's been falsely accused. And so he's willing to put his citizenship and all of the rights and privileges that go with it to work for him, to protect him from this kind of an abuse of power. Which brings us to really the main point that I wanted to make out of this passage before we come to our time of communion together. Citizenship's a tough thing because we go through waves. There's times we love our country. There's times we despise the things that it's doing. And it's kind of always been that way. Church history has been the ebb and flow of persecution of governments against the church. For the first few centuries of church history, the church was very mistreated by the Roman Empire. And then all of a sudden, Christianity became the religion in the Roman Empire. And then for a while, we were persecuted again. We were driven away. And then we became, especially here in America, we became the dominant mode of thinking in America. And now we're kind of being pushed out again. So there's this constant ebb and flow of acceptance and rejecting of the Christian faith in different societies. And wherever we are at in that cycle, we have upon us specific commands relating to our citizenship and our role as citizens in any given country. And I think it's important to carefully distinguish in those things what our role as citizens are and what our role as citizens isn't. Do the searches through the scriptures. You guys know I have preached here that citizenship in this country is a great gift. It comes with a lot of protections, and we should make the most of them. We should use them. We should use whatever rights and privileges our citizenship in this country grants us to further the cause of freedom, not the cause of tyranny. We should, especially as Paul gives us commands, to pray for our leaders that we might lead quiet, peaceful lives in all godliness and sincerity. That means that we're to be exercising our spiritual influence in this country and our civic influence in this country to see that our government doesn't begin to clamp down on the church. It allows us to continue to do what it is we're supposed to do. We are told to obey any authorities that are over us. But we're also told to carefully distinguish what's an actual authority and what is a usurped authority. Because when we obey the authorities, we have to distinguish what authority do they actually have. Does the government have the right to tell us you're not allowed to gather on Sundays to worship? They don't have that right. And so if they come down with a command that says don't gather on Sundays to worship, and we say, nope, we're going to gather on Sundays to worship, we are well within our rights. We're not violating the biblical command to obey our government. Now, if they tell us you need to go 55 miles an hour heading down to Peru, should we obey that command? Rats. You mean I can't claim Christian privileges? You have no right to command me how to drive my own car. Sure they do. They have the right to set up rules by which society can function orderly. Just imagine getting through an intersection without rules for who's supposed to go when. Ever try that? The more people you have crammed into one place, the more regulation you need to manage the interactions, right? So we have to very, very carefully distinguish those things and decide what is our right as citizens, what is our duty as citizens, and what is our right before God. When Jesus told us to give unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and give to God the things that are God's, I don't think he's just saying, just pay your taxes and forget it. I think he's saying, take a look at the commands I've given you. Take a look at the roles I've established for government. Now, which ones are we supposed to do in obedience to the government? Which ones does government not have the right to tell us? Spheres of authority is a very important concept. God has created governments. Romans 13 is very clear on that. Governments are created to keep order in the world, because imagine the unrestrained expression of human sinfulness. What would it look like? Well, we'd be back to the days before Noah. And if we think it's bad now, imagine what it would be like with no government to restrain the sinful impulses of men. That's why God instituted human government after the flood. Okay? So the government does have a sphere of authority, but the home also has a sphere of authority. God created families before he created government. The roles of parents to children is much more established than the role of government. It's much more fundamental. And if the government tries to interfere in the life of the family, they are usurping authorities. The church has a proper sphere of authority. The church can usurp its sphere of authority. So if the church tries to step in and be telling governments and families what to do in certain areas, then it's usurping its authority and doesn't need to be listened to. And so we have to do the study. We have to do the thinking to be able to establish those lines and say, what is it that, what rights does God given to parents in their sphere of authority? What rights has God given to the church in its sphere of authority? What rights has God given to the government in its sphere of authority? And those things should be respected. Understanding that God has granted all of those different spheres of authorities comes from an understanding that it is God who rules in the kingdoms of men, as Daniel said. It's Daniel 4:17. The sentence is by decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will and sets over it the lowliest of men. God is in control of the nations, whether we like the way the vote went or not. We vote, we exercise our rights and privileges as citizens, we exercise our responsibility as believers in Christ, but the end result is God's purpose for the nations. Hey, that can bring a lot of comfort. It's like, oh boy, that's not the way I wanted it to go, but okay, God's got a purpose and plan for this, right? Acts 17:26, Paul said this, he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place. What does that mean? God's in control of the affairs of nations. He knew America would occupy these borders at this point in time because that was part of his plan. I don't think it's any less part of his plan that you and I occupy the place we do at the time we do. Did God purpose you to be an American citizen at the time you are? Have you ever wondered and wished you lived at a different time in history? I have before. Like, boy, sometimes I wish I'd have lived during the pioneering days. Wouldn't that be something? Forging through the wilderness, trying to carve your way into life, and you know, having to cut down all the logs to build your house. Wouldn't that have been something? But you know, the plain fact of the matter is God didn't see fit for me to be born at that time. As much as I don't like it, I was born in the time of cell phones and computers and gadgets. Does that mean that God wants me engaged in this sphere for his glory? Paul is presented with a fantastic opportunity in this chapter. And I don't want to stretch this too far beyond what the text tells us, but just as a way of application, to say here he is, he's about ready to be beaten, but he's able to draw upon something that God gave him without Paul asking for it, Roman citizenship. Our lives are in God's hands. How much of your life did you not ask for? Did you not have a decision in? Did you have a decision who your parents were? You know, there's some goofy people challenging those things in courts. You know, I didn't ask you to be my parents, so therefore I'm going to separate legally from you, and you're not going to be my parents anymore. It's happening. Okay, this is the crazy reasoning of people. When we divorce ourselves from God's standard in his word, this is the crazy reasoning that people will come up with. Today, what happens in many people's minds is it's all about my choice and my decision, and there are people that are trying to alter their DNA because they didn't ask for it. Did you ask for your genetic makeup that made you as tall as you are? I didn't ask for this, but there it is. I mean, yes, there are some things that our responsibility affects. I've got a larger build than some people. That's not going to change. But do I have to carry as much of it as I do? Probably not. I recognize that. That's part of my choice and my responsibility with what God's given me. But I didn't ask to be born to my parents. God didn't see fit to get my permission before I was born in Canton, Ohio. And he didn't ask you either, but here's the plain fact of the matter. You were born where you were because it was part of God's plan for you in your life. And whatever circumstances come along with that are something that he has given to you and he wants you to exercise for his glory. You an American citizen? Use it. Don't waste it. Are you a resident here in Mendota or in the area? Use it. Don't waste it. Whatever circumstances God has given you in your life, and I'm not trying to draw this out ad infinitum, because there are some things that we have to make decisions on, and not every circumstance has to be born under. We can fix it sometimes. So please understand, I'm not trying to say, you know, hey, you fell and broke your leg. That's just part of God's plan for your life. Just let it go. Go to the doctor. Get it fixed if you can. But understand, too, there's some things that can't be fixed. And at some point, we might have to say, you know what? This might be God's purpose for me. Psalm 139 is fantastic. I want to just close by reading this, because it talks about God's intimate knowledge of each and every one of us and his purposes for us. He made Paul a Roman citizen without asking Paul about it. He was born that way. And Paul was able to delineate and discern when it was time to use that and when it was time not to. Psalm 139, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down, you know when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it altogether. Your parents ever say to you, I know you better than you know yourself? Sometimes it's true with parents, but you know what? It's absolutely true with God. He knows you better than you know you, because he made you. You hem me in behind and before. You lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's high. I cannot attain it. Where shall I go from your spirit, or where shall I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you're there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, your right hand shall hold me. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. How precious to me are your thoughts, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I could count them, they're more than the sand. I awake and I'm still with you. Now, Queen Esther was put in a position she didn't ask for. And her uncle Mordecai gave her a little bit of wisdom that echoes down to us today. You know, if you don't do something about this, God will raise up deliverance for the Jewish people. That's for certain. But perhaps you were put here for just such a time as this. You know, folks, you were put here for such a time as this. There's no doubt of it. God has superintended the events of life so that you are here now for some purpose. Use it. As we come to our time of communion this morning, and we think about those very things, God has orchestrated your life in this way. Christ died for you. You know, he didn't just die for people in general. You were on his mind. It was intended for you. Think about that as we take communion together. We're going to take just a few moments of quietness so you can talk to the Lord and praise him, confess sin if you need to, come to faith in Christ if you need to. You know, if you've been saying for a long time, I've been trying to prove my way, I want to stop doing that, and I just want to put my faith in Christ. He died for my sins, and I have no other answer for them. And now's the moment to do that. But let's just take these next few moments in quietness to talk to the Lord.